Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning and welcome to Sara Gone Rogue. With me, Sara Gone, where we look at all issues political and discover that most issues are political. And I hope we'll bring you an intriguing discussion and see how we can warm the cockles of your hearts or just create a sense of such rage and frustration that you get warmed up anyway. It was interesting to hear Howard talking about the MK party members who are caught up in the fighting in the Ukraine, in Donbas, who are saying they're stranded and they desperately want to come home. They went there believing that they were getting security guard training and ended up on the front lines. And Howard expressed a certain skepticism that they went there to get said training. But you have to question that dreaded old mischief maker Jacob Zuma, who is described as His Excellency President Jacob Zuma in a press release released by the MK, to advise that he had successfully completed a visit to Captain Ibrahim Traore of Burkina Faso. Now, Traore has been the interim president of Burkina Faso since 2022. And Burkina Faso has just been led by a litany, if that's the right word, of coups. And he was the youngest head of state and was, I think, quite popular for being hip and happening compared to the people who'd taken over before him. But this is a man who distanced the country from France and left the ECOWAS military grouping to protect or to have some role in disputes and fighting in the western part of Africa. It has aligned itself with China, Russia, and Turkey, of all tolerant democratic countries. And he's known for, as most coup leaders end up being known for, cracking down on things like freedom of press and political opposition. And he has unlawfully conscripted critics, journalists, activists, prosecutors, and judges. Now, Burkina Faso is still known as one of the world's least developed countries and incredibly poor, and has been subject, as has much of parts of West Africa, to jihadi insurgencies. And then a coup was attempted this year by a jihadi grouping. And he managed, and the government managed to tamper down the insurgency and prevent it from happening, which gained him popularity for the government being seen to protect much put upon residents of Burkina Faso. Now, one has to question, why is Jacob Zuma going to visit a country that holds no possible benefits for South Africa and is clearly supporting all the anti-West sentiments that are being expressed in South Africa at the moment by the ANC and presumably by Zuma? And let's not forget, Zuma's not a Democrat. He runs his party, although he says it's on the basis of consulting, etc. The only person who needs to be consulted in Jacob Zuma's party is Jacob Zuma. So I would watch that very carefully indeed. And him.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It just suddenly occurred to me that today is the 11th day of the 11th month of in which World War One ended, and 11 o'clock, an hour and a bit's time, is when it is commemorated. And the red poppy as a symbol of the end of that war and of the war itself remains quite potent. Anyway, we're looking just at the summit that took place at the beginning of the month between all the members of the Government of National Unity. Now, the meeting was called on fairly short notice by President Cyril Ramaphosa. They having last met before that, 177 days before, which was May the 8th. And it seems like what Ramaphosa was doing, because it seemed a very amiable meeting, was to ensure essentially the docility ahead of the G20 of his potential detractors in the GNU. And it appears that reporting from the event indicates that it seems to have worked, with most attention being focused on operational matters and the long delayed dispute resolution process. And contentious issues were actually just carefully excluded. Now, commentators have said that one of the risks coming out of this sort of what people have called kumbaya moment is that it seems to highlight consensus seeking and conflict avoidance, and creates a risk that the GNU partners are becoming complacent, and both within the GNU and in the political sphere more broadly. Some small economic gains in the last few months may bolster that risk of complacency. And the concern is that it prevents South Africa from shifting the ANC-dominated trajectory that we're currently on, because we have yet to see the benefits of the GNU in the broad sense. And while there may be ministries under, for example, the DA that are appearing to be making headway, particularly public works and home affairs, we're not seeing the real benefits which we urgently need and have been urgently needed for a very long time in terms of real economic growth and fixed investments. And that, of course, is highlighted in the worst possible sense by the official unemployment rate of over 30% and the youth unemployment rate of 60%. And nothing is changing, and the ANC is doing nothing, and in fact doubling down on things like race-based laws, BEE, public procurement, etc. It's threatening expropriation without compensation. It hasn't appeared to have done much about either the size or the inefficiency of much of the public sector. And of course, the Madlanga Commission and the Ad Hoc Committee of Parliament, looking at the crime and corruption and impunity in the justice cluster, particularly in the police and at high levels in the police, suggests that we're just becoming more aware of the problems we have been sucked into. And you know, Cyril seems to have got everyone on board. I mean, his spokesman said that the leaders were unanimous, that the GNU is united and strong, and they agreed that a forum of party leaders would meet regularly to provide strategic political direction of the work of the GNU. It does look worrying. I mean, the DA has said that the ANC has agreed to discussion about the direction of foreign policy, in which there is a huge divide between the DA and some of the other GNU partners and the ANC. And the ANC has kept foreign affairs very, very close to its chest since the GNU was formed last June. Okay, but I think it's very unlikely, since the ANC, I cannot see the ANC succeeding with Trump for reasons that have to do with the ANC and reasons that have to do with Trump's own perceptions of South Africa. And the swing to support by China in particular, and to some extent by Russia, now, you know, all the sort of anti-West, pro-West divisions on the issue of foreign policy, I don't see how there's going to be agreement reached on that in that regard. Just to sort of remind you of the remember the Paul Mashatile bodyguard assault case, where a group of eight bodyguards got out of a car and did damage to another car and assaulted the driver of the other car for no justifiable apparent reason. They apply to have their case dismissed in court. Yes, it's still going on. But the magistrate held that there was enough video evidence to suggest that there was a case to answer. And remember that a criminal court action has to be guilt has to be found on beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's quite a difficult onus. Whereas a South African Police Service's investigation into the matter found that because the person who took the video could not have confirmed that the video had been taken by him and alleged that he'd received death threats and similar things prior to the investigation, you know, while the investigation was happening, suggests that if the lower standard couldn't find them guilty of misconduct, I hope measures have been put in place to make the video evidence verifiable and protect the maker of that video evidence that suggests that they very much did what they were accused of doing. I mean, that video evidence went absolutely viral, and I think the sort of arrogance and power-hungry nature of the eight men involved made sure that, you know, they weren't paying attention to what everybody else was watching. So we'll see that drag on and on.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, we've spoken about Solidarity's billboard advertising on the highway intended to embarrass the government when everyone comes to town for the G20. And we've talked about the fact that the GNU has sort of come into line to behave nicely while all the dignitaries are in town. But I thought, given the fact that it's due to happen next week, next week or the week, I'm losing track, the 22nd and 23rd of November, I thought I'd get a take on what exactly is the G20, what does it do, and is it really worthwhile having? And for this discussion, I've invited veteran financial journalist Jonathan Katzenellenbogen to join me. Jonathan, do we have you on the line?
Yes. Hi, Sarah. Good morning.
Morning. Let's go start with the basics, and that what exactly is the G20? How is it comprised?
The G20 consists, contrary to its name, G20, it consists of 19 countries, most of whom are the largest 20 countries in terms of GDP. That is, except Argentina and South Africa. South Africa is, I'm sorry to say this, a bit of an imposter here, mm-hmm. but it was granted its G20 status because of, one, the Mandela legacy, and because the G20 was originally a solely financial, a meeting place for finance ministers and governors of central banks, the governor of our Reserve Bank and our finance minister were the only representatives of our country at the time, earlier on. But later, after the global financial crisis, it was it took on a larger role, and it became a summit meeting. And in this process, South Africa was included, although we're only 40th in terms of GDP. So at work here was the Mandela legacy and relatively sophisticated and well-regulated financial markets. That was also a consideration. Okay. And so the host for the summit rotates every year. So last year it was Brazil. And for the past year, we have been had the presidency of the G20. And in the run-up to this, there have been a whole lot of meetings of finance ministers, health ministers, businesses has met. There's a B20 that has met here in Johannesburg. And now on November the 22nd and 23rd, there'll be a summit meeting. So apart from these 19 countries, which include South Africa and Argentina, of course, you know, the US, China, Russia, and all the others will be here. Putin won't be here. But and Trump, of course, has said earlier this week, over the weekend rather, that he will not be coming to South Africa. You also have the heads of the European Union and the African Union that are members. I just want to backtrack a bit and say that one of the reasons South Africa is a member is because we're an African country and Africa would not be represented mm-hmm. in the grouping. And the same for the Spanish-speaking Latin American countries. Mm-hmm. So Brazil is represented, but of course they speak Portuguese in Brazil, mm-hmm. not Spanish. Mm-hmm. Hence, they put in Argentina, which is has the largest economy of the Spanish-speaking Latin American countries.
Right. Why did it change from being what strikes me as probably more useful in finance ministers and central bank governors responding to emerging market crises to becoming a sort of world leader summit? I mean, my instincts suggest that these summits largely become whatever, or partly whatever the host country wanted to be. And I suspect that South Africa is going to punt for more involvement by African countries on various world bodies, World Trade Organization, IMF, etc. And yet we really don't carry the economic heft to justify being there. How did it come to be this sort of broad-based thing?
Well, with the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008, excuse me, there was the world leaders wanted to be seen to be doing something about the global financial crisis, the GFC as it became to be known, because of its consequences, became so big and so scary that they took on a bigger role. And since then, it's been a summit meeting. But I agree with you entirely. You know, there are two criticisms of the G20. One is that, you know, it's largely deals with economic type issues, longer term issues, some sort of crisis management issues. But, you know, these are dealt with elsewhere. Mm. The forum of all these is the finance ministers and central bank governors, heads of the Reserve Bank, are meeting in Washington during the annual meetings of the IMF and World Bank every September. And they also meet in around about in what they call their spring meetings 6 months prior to that in the Northern Hemisphere spring in about April or so. So, you know, having this is sort of a bit extraneous. But I think one of the reasons it's perpetuated is because, not because of what comes out of it necessarily, is that it brings together a lot of world leaders. Mm. I think over 60 world leaders, heads of countries, prime ministers and presidents, heads of government and presidents, will be there at the in Johannesburg. So there's a great chance for one-on-one meetings, mm-hmm. regional meetings, and so forth, and other meetings that don't have much to do with the G20 at all. Mm. So it's like, you know, so many people go to the funerals of great leaders when they pass away,
yeah.
not out of, you know, partially out of mourning, but also because it affords the opportunity to meet many leaders who will be in one place at one time. And these one-on-one meetings are useful. So I think that's a large reason for it. And that is the reason it's perpetuated. Mm. And after all, you know, if people want to come to this, they can come and take advantage of it. And, you know, the sorts of issues that are raised here are raised elsewhere in the UN and in financial fora and on one-on-one meetings. So, you know, its value, I think, really is these one-on-one meetings. Mm. And, you know, they kind of countries have a lot going on with other countries. And, you know, they need head of state or prime the head of government input, and this is where it comes, you know, towards pushing towards the final deal in these one-on-one meetings.
Mm.
One of the big issues that President Ramaphosa wants to raise at the meeting in 10 days' time is that of global inequality. And last week, Professor Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner, economics prize winner, and much celebrated by the left because of his views on development and aid and so forth, came up with this report commissioned by South Africa. President Ramaphosa commissioned it about reducing global inequality. And the proposal is, guess what? Let's have a permanent panel looking into global inequality. So it raises the, it could raise this on the international agenda. But I think that, you know, it's better to have more inequality than less. And it's better for social cohesion and democracy. But at the same time, to achieve to reduce inequality, the experience universally has been that, you know, in the early stages of industrialization and rapid growth, there's inequality grows. But as governments get the resources to deal with inequality, and if governance is good and their healthcare, education systems are good, they can then reduce inequality.
Mm.
My view is that the stress, certainly for South Africa at this stage, should be just growth, growth, growth.
Yeah.
You know, China, the reduction in poverty, and aim at the reduction in poverty, which does take place through growth. Mm. China is the greatest example of this. You know, they're spectacular economic growth for decades of above around 10%. At first didn't yield much, but later there was a tremendous reduction in poverty. And now, guess what? There's a reduction in inequality.
Mm.
So making this an aim on its own does really little good. But, you know, in the end, countries will follow their own policies. Mm. On this.
Yeah, well, I must say the stress of global inequality I find rather embarrassing, because ANC policy has consistently, even having lost the majority voting portion of the public, and it's now a minority party, albeit the biggest one, it not just doesn't change failed policy that's been in place for 20 odd years, but it really is doing nothing to adopt policies that will see the growth and see that desperate need to reduce unemployment in a situation where we have an emergent black middle class, and the inequality, the gap between the poor and the black and the black upper middle classes is greater than the inequality between the poor and white South Africa. So, it almost seems like he's just, the embarrassment is he's out there trying to beg for favors and aid and not do the hard work which those countries, whether they're autocrats or democrats, have done in achieving higher levels of growth.
I agree with you absolutely. South Africa needs that growth. You know, it's 1%, around 1% growth this year. It's totally inadequate. So for the past few years, in fact, our per capita income has been slightly declining, and rates of poverty rates in South Africa have initially declined, but since I think about 2011, this has not been the case, and inequality has increased. I just wonder what if this expert panel were commissioned to do a report on South Africa, what would they say? It would be useful for Stiglitz and Co. to come up with a report on South Africa and look at the various policies. You know, BE, you know, these big corporate stakes held by empowerment groups. And the empowerment groups have been able to access financing to get hold of it. What's their what's their real value added? Has this added to productivity and has led to inequality without really the benefits of growth? Because it's just a switch in ownership rather than the creation of new assets.
New business. Yeah.
The hold on, another avenue of BE, of course, has been the state-owned enterprises and the state through procurement, which is, we don't know the extent of it, but there's a premium to be paid by the in procurement by BE groups, and we don't know how much of this is accepted by the state, but that also that can't lead to economic growth and certainly leads to some sort of redistribution, but again, it's at a penalty for the economy as a whole.
Yeah.
It would have been very useful had this report included at least an addendum on inequality on South Africa and its reasons. I think it might have been quite embarrassing.
Yeah. I think there's probably from a tactical point of view, there's going to be some reliance on the fact that South Africa was removed from the Financial Action Task Force's grey list as not providing sufficient means to deal with funding for terrorism and similar activity. How big a thing is that actually likely to be in the greater scheme of things?
Had we been on this grey list, it would be pretty embarrassing.
Yeah.
After all, here we're hosting the finance ministers from the largest economies in the world. And, they say, hang on, you're still on the grey list. What's happening there? And getting off that grey list, they've worked the Treasury, which is well run. It's one government department that is well run and has good people. Managed to get us off it, off that, but we couldn't. It would have been raised a big question over our hosting of the event had we continued to be on that. Mm-hmm. And I think also, that was important for them to do, to really rush this as they've done over the past 18 months in dealing with this, and it was the right thing to do because the implication is, you're laundering basically your money laundering rules allow you to launder dirty money, and you're open to terrorist financing. So the big thing is we've got to really stay off that the Financial Action Task Force's list. And the other thing that I see that Ramaphosa did on the eve of the of the summit, which has hardly been noticed, or the connection has hardly been noticed, but I think there is a very strong connection in this, is that he managed to get a statement from the GNU saying we're united and strong. On the first weekend of November, they all went out to the middle.
We just discussed that before you came on, that sort of seeming to get that docility of agreeing to not ruffle anybody's feathers.
Yes, at least for the next few weeks.
Yeah.
Bear in mind that the budget, medium-term expenditure framework is coming up on Wednesday.
Right. And what... we as Joburgers have our awareness of the G20 has simply been in the fact of seeing certain select areas undergo infrastructural repairs like potholes and streetlights and markings, etc. But it looked at from our perspective, except for the direct some of the improvements on the direct links between the Sandton where people are staying and the airport and Nasrec where they'll be having the summit, surely the rot of in Joburg will not go unnoticed.
No, I don't know. It won't. But they'll be. Essentially, there's, I think many will be staying here in Sandton, where the smart hotels are. So they'll be staying here, and they'll be going to Nazareth, so that they can go along the M1 from Sandton.
Mm.
And, you know, they'll be rushed along. There'll be lots of convoy escort with motorcycles and so forth, making it a lot easier. So they won't, you know, they won't go through the parts of Johannesburg where there are lots of potholes. And, you know, Sandton has been cleaned up quite a bit.
Mm.
You know, they're fresh road markings. Most of the robots seem to be in working order. Although I just wonder with the rain, what's going to happen now?
Right.
Because, you know, the potholes suddenly appear from nowhere after the rain.
Right.
And robots suddenly are not working. So they might have to deal with a lot of maintenance. But the problem is, you know, this is a one-off. This is one-off maintenance by the council for a what they call a high impact event.
Yeah.
But forget it. You know, this is not this sort of level of maintenance isn't going to continue after this event.
Right.
So it's very much a one-off.
Just finally, do we need it? I mean, is it of any value?
Look, yeah, I don't think it really breaks the budget. I calculated that it's something like 0.04% of the budget. You know, clearly we could have bought a few schools with that and established a few schools with that and done a lot else. But it's not going to offset the need for a VAT tax rise or, it's a pity, you know, but the ANC likes this sort of international recognition. It puts South Africa on the map. But I think, you know, it is a waste of resources and time. Let someone else do it and let the president go and see that. But, you know, kind of governments love this sort of glory. You know, it brings people to town and they think they're going to get lots of investment and business out of this, but it doesn't really work out that way.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Just was looking at something completely different, and it seems like Russia doing business as usual, is their claims that the Russians have charged an Antarctic marine biologist with high treason. Now, this is a man, Dr. Leonard Pshenichov, who's a Ukrainian citizen. He was probably originally a Russian citizen, but has been for decades a Ukrainian citizen. He was preparing proposals with the United States and Anglo-Saxon and Western countries to establish an extensive marine protected areas or extensive marine protected areas in the Antarctic. And the result of this, and this is Russia's problem, is it would result in the loss of opportunities for Russia to exploit hydrocarbon resources on the continental shelf of Antarctica. Now, mineral resource activities in Antarctica have been outlawed since 1998, when a commission came into being that would a large number of countries from around the world to manage the balance between exploiting the resources of Antarctica and actually protecting the marine diversity. And I think part of the problem is the general consensus is that if the marine resources and the wildlife goes insufficiently protected, it will diminish very, very quickly. So the world body that was established in 1998 was the Commission for Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources. And it was in a recent meeting in Tasmania that they were scheduled to discuss the fishing limits and the areas that are now being blocked by China and Russia to drive fishing interests and mining interests. It comprises 26 countries and the EU. And it was the commission came into being as far back as 1982, specifically for the purpose of managing these conflicting issues. Now, apparently, there are about 70 billion tons of hydrocarbons in the region. Chernichov was arrested in Russian-occupied Crimea. So this was obviously, you know, in the context of the Ukraine war and Russia's dominance of Crimea since 2014. And apparently, unsurprisingly, it has been very difficult to find out the details of this case. And he's being prosecuted inter alia for quote, using his personal laptop to perform duties legally mandated by the commission in preparing materials for an analytical report containing proposals to restrict krill harvesting. And in typical sort of Russian fashion, the Russians are both partaking in these creation of these marine protection areas, and at the same time trying to diminish the impact of it for their own benefit and exploitation. And I presume it must be because of his residency in Crimea, despite having been a Ukrainian citizen, that he's effectively facing treason charges for following policies that ostensibly have been approved by Russia, but now not really being approved by Russia. And so Russia's playing this very duplicitous game in this context to clearly promote its own interests. China is too, but the arrest of someone who has been involved in this process for decades, who's involved in the research on the protection of the ecosystem there, really is, in a way, only the Russians could do it, and the question is whether they would get away with it, and whether the review of any policy and his arrest will actually be discussed at the commission in the near future. So on the agenda, or should be on the agenda, is whether the treaty, which invited Russians to future meetings, should make them release Russia's involvement at all. But I guess the question then becomes, is it better to be in the tent looking out rather than out of the tent looking in? Anyway, so that's an unusual sort of, as I say, business as usual by Russia, but on a world stage, but in an area that doesn't otherwise attract a lot of attention. Now, apparently, onto another issue, the city of Johannesburg is paying five times more than standard rates to electrify informal settlements. And this has particularly come up in the context of six informal settlements on the outskirts of the center of Johannesburg. And it appears that as much as 144,000 rand per connection is the cost of connecting these shackland areas, compared with a national standard of 25,000 to 30,000 rand. And apparently, as you can imagine, there is in certain areas particular chaos in this regard, and much more transparency and openness and systems need to be in place to manage this process properly. Surprise.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
An interesting argument that is now arising in the big commentators on the what becoming increasingly known as the woke right is, came out with Tucker Carlson accusing Israel of really having the US under its thumb in terms of the policies it pursues and the wars it has to fight, and that Donald Trump's relationship with Israel and going into attacking Iran was entirely at the behest of Israel with no regard to American interests. Now, this is almost a trope which came around with respect to which has been repeated with respect to Israel's pressure on America, alleged to have started the invasion into Iraq after 9/11. Now, what the reality is that Israel repeatedly warned America at the time, George W. Bush, that going into Iraq would be a mistake, because in diminishing the authority of Saddam Hussein, that would really just increase the potency of their biggest enemy, Iran, with whom they'd fought in an 8-long-year bitter war. Prime Minister Sharon at the time was one of those people warning the American government not to do this. And much of the warnings which were repeated appeared in the big legacy media of the Washington Post, New York Times, and LA Times that reported it and reported it correctly. And it seems like that the myth of Israel lobbying for the Iraq war was really created in the Stephen Walton, John Mearsheimer, between 2008 book, The Israel Lobby and the U.S. Foreign Policy. And although they never proved it, they couldn't really find the evidence for it. But they were essentially, it appears, trying to cast onto Israel what was the feelings of support for such a invasion by neoconservative Jewish politicians and commentators at the time. But it's amazing how something that not been proved comes around again in one form or the other to denigrate the role of the U.S. in relation to its relationship with Israel. Israel is not that powerful. And, you know, we've just got to be on the lookout for that, essentially revisiting a trope that was massaged back in the time of the Iraq War. Israel did come on board with the Americans after the Americans decided formally to embark on the war. But looking back at the era of that in retrospect does not make blaming Israel for it happening in the first place justifiable in any way whatsoever. Just thought of something interesting that's peaking up in the wars against Israel and Jews, and the ingrowing anti-Semitism and the massaging of tropes to do that. Here is yet another one. Well, thank you for joining me this morning, and I hope to refer you to my Substack of the same name, Sara Gone Rogue, at sara281.substack.com, where you'll see a variety of writings on areas that I think are politics and are politically relevant. And I hope that you will join me again next week. Thank you.